When daylight came, the magistrates sent their officers with the order, "Release those men." The jailer reported these instructions to Paul. "The magistrates have sent an order for your release. Now you are free to go in peace." But Paul said to the officers, "We are Roman citizens. They gave us a public flogging and threw us into prison without trial. Are they now going to smuggle us out by stealth? No, indeed. Let them come in person and escort us out." The officers reported his words to the magistrates. Alarmed to hear that they were Roman citizens, they came and apologized. Paul was very proud of his status as a Roman citizen. And if we're going to understand something about the world he lived in, and the assumptions with which people worked in that world, we'll need to understand just a little bit about Rome and Roman citizenship. It's so important to Paul that he mentions it in two other places in the stories in the Acts of the Apostles. I've just read from Acts 16, 35 following, but if you look at 21, 39 and 22, 25, you'll find the same story. Paul is being manhandled by Roman soldiers or Roman officials, and he stops them short by saying, "Before you push me around any further, you'd better be aware that I'm a Roman citizen." These are stories that remind us that the great thing about being a Roman citizen was that you had certain kinds of guaranteed protection. You had privileges and liberties that were not available to everybody. You were different from slaves, obviously, but also different from that rather vague class of people that the Romans called peregrini, the origin of our word pilgrims, a word that essentially just means outsiders. These would be people who lived in the towns and cities but didn't have the rights of citizens. They might be migrant workers or foreigners of some other kind. So even within the empire, there were lots of different ways of living. And by the time you got to the barbarians who lived outside the Roman borders, frightful people like Celts, then, of course, you were in deep trouble. But what were some of those liberties and protections that citizens enjoyed? If you were a citizen, you could make a will. You could do what you liked with your property and give it to whom you wanted. You could sue people in the law courts. Usually, as we'll see later, a rather expensive business, because you had to pay out considerable sums of money in bribes and sweeteners for the magistrates. Unfortunately, you could also be sued in the law courts, which was just as expensive for exactly the same reasons. You could marry without asking anybody's permission. You could vote. You could stand for election. You could travel. And if you went to another city in the Roman Empire that was regarded as being of equal status to the one you'd just left, you could exercise all your rights as a citizen there as well. Being a Roman citizen was a bit like having a British passport in the early 20th century. You could go more or less anywhere and expect to be treated properly. There were various ways of acquiring citizenship, and we hear a bit about it again in the Acts of the Apostles, where one of the Roman officials says to Paul that it cost him a great deal of money to buy his rights as a citizen. And Paul replies, he was born a citizen. And indeed, that little detail shows that his family had probably been settled in Tarsus for quite a long time, because it was in 66 BC that all the inhabitants of Tarsus, in what's now southeastern Turkey, were given citizenship rights by the Roman government. So being a citizen was not a small thing. And if we're to understand Paul's world, we have to understand first and foremost that this is a world in which anything corresponding to our idea of universal human rights did not exist. There was no such thing as equality before the law. Being a citizen guaranteed you many things. Being a peregrinus, a migrant, or a low-paid worker gave you a few limited privileges before the law, and being a slave gave you none at all. Paul probably came from a reasonably well-to-do family, but not so rich that he didn't have to earn his living. His family was clearly well off enough to send him to Jerusalem for a long period of training in traditional Jewish scholarship. But we also learn that he had acquired a trade as a tent maker. So moderately well off, on the edges of the upper artisan class, some spare money going around, but above all, the crucial distinction, a citizen. Set that alongside the other two classes. If you were a migrant, a peregrinus, you could move around, but you had no guarantee that your legal status would remain the same. You couldn't vote. You couldn't make a will. When you died, your property would be confiscated by the city. You could be tortured, which a Roman citizen couldn't be. And you could be subject to any number of painful and humiliating forms of execution, including crucifixion, which was not a punishment given to citizens. It's not a matter of class or income in our sense. There would be citizens who were not very well off, and there would be migrants who were quite well off. It was a matter of security and identity, a matter of what you could take for granted without worrying. It was a distinction most visible in urban life, in the life of the cities. And we need to remember that the cities of Paul's time were very mixed, very cosmopolitan. We mustn't fall into the trap of thinking that the world of the New Testament was a world of simple peasants and ancient Romans in togas. It was a world commercially very active, culturally very creative, where languages and traditions mingled freely within the life of the cities, held together rather unstably by two main things: the authority of the Roman Emperor and the Greek language. A rather odd kind of Greek by the standards of classical Greece, but nonetheless an effective medium for communication. I suppose you could compare it with the way in which the English language goes through a number of startling and surprising transformations as a language of commerce and trade, let's say in Southeast Asia. Anyone who's ever spent any time in Singapore will recognize that there are very vigorous forms of English spoken there which are not exactly those of the home counties. And the Greek that St. Paul and his fellows spoke would have been that kind of language. Vigorous, crisp, often eloquent, but not quite classical. As I say, it wasn't a matter of wealth and income. Some non-citizens had quite a lot of money from trade, but they couldn't dispose of it. They would be mobile, they could take their business around the empire. Take St. Paul's friends, Aquila and Priscilla, whom we meet in several places in the New Testament. A very attractive couple, I've always thought. Sensible, hospitable, entirely supportive of Paul and Apollos and others. We don't know whether they were citizens. Probably not, because, of course, they were exiled from Rome, along with other Jews, by the Emperor Claudius. They move around the empire as traders, and they've clearly got quite a lot of disposable income. They have a house big enough for the church to meet in, and they can obviously give generous support to wandering apostles. Nonetheless, they are much more insecure than Paul as a citizen. And worst of all is the position of the slave. The slave, remember, is literally the property of someone else. The slave has no rights of movement or travel. The slave can only travel with his or her master. A slave cannot marry except with the master's consent. A slave, if brought up before the law courts, is routinely tortured. And I do mean routinely. It was assumed that no slave would tell the truth unless forced to do so. So if they were giving evidence, the default position was that they would have to be tortured. They could be killed with impunity by their owners. In well brought up Roman circles, it was regarded as slightly vulgar to go around killing your slaves. But the sanctions were social rather than moral or legal. And of course, the body of the slave, male or female, was entirely at the disposal of the master or indeed mistress. A slave could be highly educated. A master might decide to invest in a slave, to expose them to all the best resources of classical education, so that they could be, let's say, a tutor to the younger generation, so that they could help a master write his memoirs, so that they could do the business side of things. A slave could, in some circumstances, accumulate money, and therefore could sometimes buy his or her freedom. But that depended on whether the master would allow it or not. If the master was in trouble with the law, the slave was liable to share their punishment. If a master was convicted of treason in the Roman Empire, it was not unknown for the entire household to be executed. In the case of slaves, probably by crucifixion. That's the Roman world, the world of the empire and of the great cities, the world Paul inhabits, a world which we sometimes forget is more strange to us and our assumptions than we might ever have thought. And I labour these points about the legal status of different groups in the empire to underline the point I made earlier. This is a world that has no conception of universal human rights or dignities. A world in which where you fitted into the social pattern determined pretty well everything about you. I won't at this stage say very much about what Paul does with all this in his teaching. But one thing that is just worth noting before I pass on is that on the evidence of a letter like Paul's first letter to the Christians in Corinth, the Christian communities included a great variety of social characters. Paul, with his inimitable tactlessness, reminds the Corinthians in the first chapter of the first letter that not many of them came from respectable or well-born backgrounds. Later on, in chapter 6, he rattles off a list of disreputable characters and says, "Such were some of you." And the impression is that there was, therefore, in Corinth, quite a strong representation of non-citizen groups. Shopkeepers, migrant workers, household slaves. But also, in 1 Corinthians 6, we find St. Paul being strongly critical of Christians who choose to go to law to settle disputes. And that must mean citizens who had the right to institute legal proceedings. So, if you begin with that picture of Roman society and turn to something like the first letter to Corinth, you'll see how eccentric the Christian community would have looked to almost anybody in the world around at the time. A place in which slaves and citizens, traders and migrant workers mingled together. A very rare place indeed. But more of that tomorrow. Paul, the Roman citizen. But of course, Paul inherited another very stratified, very strict tradition. He was a Jew whose name was originally Saul, and who, he tells us, came initially from the tribe of Benjamin. He belongs to that huge class of Jewish entrepreneurs and traders, merchants, travellers and teachers, called the diaspora, the Jewish people dispersed around the Mediterranean in the centuries just before the beginning of the Christian era. As I've said, the likelihood is that his family had been settled in Tarsus for some time. Tarsus was an obvious place for traders and others to settle. Tucked into the corner of southeast Turkey, it was a great regional center, a major trading city. It had been given privileges by the Roman government in the century before Christ. It's even the place where Antony first met Cleopatra. So when Paul, speaking to the Roman commander, says that he is a citizen of, in the old translation, no mean city, we see what was in his mind. Tarsus had amphitheatres and baths and paved streets and a reputation and a resident governor. But Paul seems to have spent quite a bit of his early manhood in Jerusalem. He refers to having sat at the feet of Gamaliel. And we know Gamaliel from the Acts of the Apostles, the member of the Jewish council who advises against punishing the early Christians severely, who famously says, "Let's see how this turns out, because if it comes from God, it's going to work and we're going to look very foolish." But we know about Gamaliel also from Jewish sources. We know that he belonged to the family of the great Hillel, perhaps the most famous of the first century Jewish rabbis. We know that he inherited a lineage of teaching and tradition which took a fairly gentle view of the legal obligations binding on religious Jews. And we have many stories in Jewish texts of the rivalry between Hillel's disciples and those of Shammai, a much more strict, rigorous teacher. Gamaliel, in fact, emerges in the Jewish texts as a very impressive figure indeed. There's one text which says, since the death of Rabban Gamaliel, true knowledge of the law has passed away from Israel. And yet, oddly, we have very few specific judgments ascribed to Gamaliel, as if his reputation was just a little bit clouded. And it's impossible not to suspect that this had something to do with the fact that he had recommended clemency towards the early Christians, perhaps even that he had been the teacher of the notorious Saul from Tarsus. So if Paul had been a student at the feet of this gentle Irenic character, how on earth did he become such a savage enemy of the early church? That early church which his master and teacher had been so understanding about. This is where we have to read the Acts of the Apostles very carefully. And if we do read it carefully, we can, I think, see that at this particular moment in the history of the early church, some unusual alliances were being formed. You remember the great speech that Stephen gives to the Jewish council in the Acts of the Apostles. A speech where this enthusiastic and rather reckless Christian teacher explains why the coming of Jesus has made the worship of the temple a thing of the past, and explains also why the death and resurrection of Jesus display the experts in the law as being traitors to their own tradition. It's very strong stuff indeed. It was certainly calculated to annoy the priests who ran the temple. But it was also calculated to annoy those who laid great emphasis on keeping the law in full rigor. In other words, Stephen alienated both the Sadducees, the priestly class, and the Pharisees, the lay enthusiasts. And it seems as if, at that point, there is a tactical alliance between the priests and the lay experts, and Paul becomes a bridge figure. A young man named Saul, so he's described when we first meet him. When Stephen is stoned to death, the witnesses who begin the stoning strip off their clothes and lay them at the feet of a young man named Saul. This young man is the one who is to pursue the policies of the chief priests against the Christian church. And we read in Acts 9 of the ferocity with which this was done. It's not difficult to imagine in the mind of this young man some very deep tensions. Brought up as a rather liberal Pharisee, he's now allying himself with the corrupt hierarchy of the temple, which the Pharisees did not like at all. And that must have been a hard place to be. It's interesting that when later on he himself appears before the Jewish council in Acts chapter 23, he quite deliberately provokes a quarrel between the two parties in the council, setting the Pharisees and Sadducees against each other. Because he knows from the inside just how deep those divisions run. So I don't think that Paul's record as a persecutor of the church tells us that the story of his relationship with Gamaliel is untrue. On the contrary, it's not at all unusual for a gifted and enthusiastic student to revolt very sharply against a revered teacher. And there, in the story of Stephen's speech, we have what may have been the watershed, the provocative moment when Paul realized that he could not go along with his old teacher's tolerant attitude to this new heretical group. The moment when he decided he would have to throw in his lot against all his instincts with the wealthy, greedy, and self-perpetuating priestly caste of the temple. I've alternated in the last few minutes between the two names, Saul and Paul. It wasn't at all unusual for a Jew living in the diaspora to have a name used in the family and in the synagogue, a Jewish name, and a name for public consumption, an official Roman name. Paulus is a common enough Roman name, and indeed, in the Acts of the Apostles, Paul meets a Roman governor with that very name. But Shaul, Saul, the name of the first king of Israel, was the name used in the household. A practice that survived in many Jewish families in Europe well into the 20th century and is not unknown still in some Jewish circles. I might add in brackets that probably the reason Paul's Jewish name is never given in Greek as Saulos is that the word Saulos in Greek has some very unfortunate connotations indeed, which in a mixed audience I'd better not go into. So Paul has a ready-made second identity. He is Paulus, a citizen, a traveller, an artisan, as well as being Shaul, a Jewish teacher, an expert in the law. And for a brief, hectic and heady period, the leader of what is almost a terrorist snatch squad. But the point is that the Jewish world Paul inhabits is just as stratified, just as strict as the Roman world he inhabits. Again, it's about identities. It's about savage quarrels about who is a real insider, who is a real Jew, who has the real authority to settle disputes. Priests, lawyers, sages. Paul belongs in a world where it matters immensely to know where you stand. Are you inside or outside? A citizen or a migrant? A free person or a slave? A Jew or a Gentile? A Pharisee or a Sadducee? A man or a woman? A world where the lines are deeply etched and there is very little possibility of crossing them. A world of complex identity politics. And just as I suggested that you might turn to the first letter to Corinth to see some of the light that is thrown on the text by this social background, so where Paul's Judaism is concerned, we might turn to the longest of his letters, the longest and most difficult, that to the Romans. Because here in his letter to the Romans, Paul presses on the nerve all the time of what is it that makes Jews distinctive or superior. All the time challenging this particular inside-outside disjunction. Do you think that because you are a law-keeping rigorist within the Jewish world, that that gives you some purchase on God and the favour of God? Think again. But do you think that because you're a Gentile welcomed into the Christian community by God's free grace, that that gives you some kind of advantage over the Jew? Think again. You can read the whole of the letter to the Romans as Paul, as it were, turning his head from side to side, saying, so now you think you're superior. Let me tell you you're not. And just because I'm telling them that they're not superior, don't go thinking you're superior. And so he goes on, chapter after chapter, swiveling the guns from side to side. It's one of the things that makes the letter to the Romans very hard reading, but also, if I may say so, very exciting reading. Well, those are some of the aspects of Paul's social world. And I think you may see why I've entitled this first talk, Insiders and Outsiders. Those were the categories that mattered intensely to Paul's contemporaries, literally matters of life and death, where your security lay, the rights you could claim, the advantages you believed you had. But there are one or two other things, just to note in passing, about the social world Paul occupies. And perhaps the most odd and important for our purposes is that in this world, nobody belongs to a religion. There is no such thing as a religion in the first Christian century. People do religious things. But if you'd gone up to somebody in the back streets of Corinth or Ephesus and asked them the sort of census question, what religion are you? They would have looked at you with complete bafflement. Nobody has a religion. There are, as Paul says wryly in 1 Corinthians 8, countless deities, gods many and lords many. And in his speech in Athens in Acts 17, he says again, very ironically, I see that you are very religious in Athens. And the word he uses means you are very meticulous about keeping in with the gods. Because gods are part of the universe. And just as you have to be polite to people who have superior social status, because otherwise they will make your life very difficult, so you'd better be polite to the gods, because they can make your life still more difficult. You may have a favorite among the gods. You may find that the temple of Jupiter is more attractive than the temple of Venus. You may like to go to the festivals there rather more than you like to go to some other temples. You might find that it was exciting to sign up as a member of an exotic Eastern cult. You might fancy the rites of Mithras and have yourself deluged in the blood of a freshly slaughtered bull. You might, if you were very reckless, decide that you were attracted by the cult of the goddess Cybele, perhaps to find out too late that the price of being a cleric in this particular group was that you had to be a eunuch. And all of these things had relatively little to do with what we think of as belonging to a religion. These were not, in the blessed language of modern government, faith communities. Being religious was part of being a citizen, part of being a slave, part of being a person in the Roman world. You have to sort out your relationships and your obligations to the gods as you have to sort out these things with anything and everyone. But there is no system to it. There's no membership except in these little unofficial cults. There's no special social territory, which is being religious rather than being anything else. You don't go to church. You don't go to synagogue. You don't go to the mosque. If you're Jewish, of course, you do go to the synagogue as a matter of practice, but that's part of being Jewish. It's part of the community, the political community, you belong to. It's not signing up to a religion. And I suppose the nearest we'd get to that today is the religious world, say, of India, with its huge profusion of gods and goddesses, its little informal groups of devotees for this or that practice or tradition, and its stubborn, total refusal to think of religion as something segregated from everything else. You belong in this society, and part of the belonging is that you do religious things just as you do other sorts of things. All of this is called making it strange, reminding us that when we open the letters of Paul, we are entering a world that will surprise us. And probably those two things, slavery and the way religion worked or didn't, those will be the two oddest things for us. I suspect that depending a bit where we were, we would also find the assumptions about the status of women quite surprising. Even well-off women, even women belonging to citizen families, had very restricted rights. Within the old Roman families, women did not even have names of their own. They were known simply by the female form of their family name. That was it. And wherever you were, whoever you were, you lived in a strictly, legally regulated environment. And it's only against the background of this that we can begin to see why Paul is so remarkable and why early Christianity felt so dangerous. But before finishing, there are two other things I just want to touch on very briefly. One is to do with the letters of Paul themselves. There's been a lot of debate in the last couple of hundred years as to whether all the letters attributed to Paul in the New Testament were really written by him. Everybody agrees that Romans, 1 and 2 Corinthians, Galatians, and the brief note to Philemon are authentic. Most people agree that the first and second letters to the church in Thessalonica are authentic. That leaves the three prison letters, as they're sometimes called, supposedly written from Paul in jail in Rome, the letters to Ephesus, Colossae, and Philippi, Ephesians, Colossians, and Philippians. And it leaves the letters to Timothy and Titus. I'm not going to go into the details of this controversy because it would take rather more than the time available, and because there seems almost no possibility of certainty. I'll say this much, though. When we're faced with the claim that one of Paul's letters is not really by Paul, we tend in the 21st century to think, so it's a forgery. That's not exactly how people would have thought at the time. Somebody who saw themselves as a loyal disciple of Paul might very well put together what they believed to be a truthful digest of what he taught and say, this is Paul. Or somebody might string together fragments of letters that Paul had written and write some connecting passages and say, this is Paul. It's the way in which many people's minds worked at the time. And to say that a text is not written in every word by Paul is definitely not to say it is a forgery. For what it's worth, my own conclusion is that the vast majority of the literature under Paul's name actually does originate with him. Unfashionably, I believe that the letter to Ephesus is from Paul, though probably written by Paul with a bit of help from somebody else. The letters to Timothy and Titus seem to me to be examples of what I just mentioned. Fragmentary notes from Paul, written up with connecting passages. There are enough rather vivid personal touches in those letters to make me feel that I don't want to write them off completely. But there are phrases there which are so unlike the Paul of Romans or Galatians, even when every allowance has been made for an older man writing, that it's quite hard to believe that the same pen wrote them. Yet, that doesn't mean that they are not apostolic documents, or, if you are a Christian, inspired documents, part of an inspired scripture. It simply means that the process by which we got them is a bit more complicated than just Paul writing things down and somebody else copying them on. In what I say tomorrow and Wednesday, I'll be depending quite heavily on the central, the longest of the letters, Romans, the Corinthian letters, Galatians, and a bit on the three prison letters and the little personal note to Philemon. I don't believe that the theology of the letters to Timothy and Titus is on the whole radically different from what is in these texts, but it is differently expressed and carries some different assumptions. So I shan't be referring to those very much. But I hope that gives just a little framework of explanation as to what I am assuming about these texts. But the last point I want to touch on is Paul himself. What kind of a person? So far, we've been sketching out the whole environment, and in the middle of it, there is, you might say, a human-shaped shadow. What kind of man? What age? What do we know of his personal life? A young man named Saul. If Stephen was martyred in Jerusalem around the year 34, then Paul was a young man at that point. In the ancient world, you definitively stopped being young, I'm sorry to say, at the age of 40. So in AD 34, Saul of Tarsus was less than 40. It's a reasonable guess that he was, in fact, about the same age as Jesus would have been, perhaps just a little younger. Jesus, born probably in 7 or 6 before the Christian era, would have been nearly 40 at the time of his crucifixion. Paul may have been a little younger, if he's perhaps in his mid-30s, around the time of Stephen's execution. And his personal life? We know from the first letter to Corinth that he did not have a wife, and that he had chosen not to have a wife to take with him on his travels. He contrasts his position with that of St. Peter and others. Given his rabbinic upbringing, the most likely theory is that he was a widower. And nothing in the first letter to Corinth tells against that. When he writes to single people, he explicitly includes those who've never been married and widowers. And I think there's a reasonable case for thinking that that was his own position. We know that his health was uncertain. We know that when he arrived in Galatia, so he tells us in his letter to Christians in Galatia, he was suffering from an ailment which made him very unattractive. Whatever was that? It could have been epilepsy. It could also have been some kind of eye disease, which would distort his face. Interestingly, there are a couple of cases in the Acts of the Apostles where Paul is described as looking intently, or peering, or screwing up his eyes. But it may well be that he suffered from one of the countless forms of eye disease carried by parasites in the Middle East, which again would explain why he looked rather unattractive, with swollen eyes and perhaps pus-laden eyelids. But he speaks, of course, famously in the second letter to Corinth of having been given a thorn in the flesh, a long-standing ailment, which was humiliating and restricting for him. And whether it was epilepsy, eye disease, lameness, or some other kind of disability, we don't know. We do know, though, that his health was a matter of concern and regularly got in the way of his work. We don't know what he looked like, but there is an intriguing early 2nd century text from Asia Minor which preserves a description of Paul approaching the city. He's about to meet the formidable Thecla, one of his early female converts in this post-biblical tradition, and we're told that he's a little man, stooped, thin-faced, with a hooked nose, bald, with a thick black beard. Exactly the type, of course, that we see in countless pictures of St. Paul in the most ancient Byzantine artistic tradition. Whether there's any historical background to it, goodness knows. It just sounds right somehow. And as a personality, a passionate man, a very powerful personality, sometimes on the basis of the letters, manipulative and possessive. When his anger runs away with him, he can be really seriously abusive towards his enemies. Even when his anger isn't quite running away with him, he can be fairly fierce, beginning a chapter in his letter to the Galatians with the words, "You idiots," is perhaps not the best way of getting the sympathy of his readers. But that forcefulness, that passion, is also shown in the way in which he expresses his fury at the way in which people he loves are being manipulated or mistreated by others. And whenever you think you're about to lose patience with Paul, turn to some of those passages, especially in 2 Corinthians. And remember that wonderful phrase where he has listed the abusive activities of some of his rivals and says, "Would you like me to treat you like that? And do you think I don't do this because I don't love you?" That sense of warmth, indignation on behalf of people, is one of the most attractive features of Paul's personality. And when again in 2 Corinthians he writes, "Is there anybody who is made to stumble in their faith, and I do not burn with indignation?" You see the instinctive generosity of the man underlying all the passion and the anger. It's always worth remembering that Paul didn't know he was writing the Bible. That's to say, When he is writing his letters, or rather dictating his letters, what we have is a flow of argument which, because Paul is an emotional man, sometimes gets so tangled in its expression that a sentence breaks off and you have to start all over again. There can be half a sentence demanding its complement and it's not there. There can be a point, as in the argument about women covering their heads in the meeting in 1 Corinthians, where Paul realizes he's got himself into far too complicated a place to explain and breaks off and says, if anybody wants to argue about this, all I have to say is, we don't do it, and moves on hastily. He doesn't know he's writing the Bible, which again doesn't mean this is not inspired scripture. It means that Paul is not taking care. There are passages of enormous elegance and eloquence. The great hymn about love in 1 Corinthians, as everyone knows. Passages where you can see he is working on how he says things and making it very beautiful. And passages where he is so absorbed in the argument that the grammar simply disappears over the horizon. But that's part of the humanity of Paul, which I hope in this first talk I've given you some flavour of. A three-dimensional personality, and one of the people in the ancient world we know most about, apart from emperors and such like. A three-dimensional personality, not, as they say, a plaster saint. A man of deep emotions, and, like all people of deep emotions, clearly finding it quite complicated to operate in a very rigid and restrictive social world. But a man who, out of all that passion and that sense of contradiction, will bring to birth in his thinking and writing a world which is indeed, as one of his opponents observes in the Acts of the Apostles, a world turned upside down.